Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the November 24th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Denver joins indoor mask mandate by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. U.S. will release oil from reserve by Josh Boak and Colleen Long, the Associated Press. After 4 years as a pawn, Seattle man returns home by Erica Knetz, the Associated Press. Denver joins indoor mask mandate. Businesses could be exempt if they require employees, customers to show proof of vaccination against COVID by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Denver will join most of the metro area in once again requiring masks be worn in indoor places starting Wednesday through, though businesses can be exempted if they demonstrate they're requiring employees and customers to show proof they're vaccinated against COVID-19. Adams, Arapahoe, and Jefferson counties also will be under nearly identical mandates, which require masks to be worn in places like stores, gyms, and entertainment venues. The counties acted in concert to help reduce the current surge's strain on the healthcare system, officials said. We are issuing what I like to call vax or mask mandate, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock said at a news conference with four health department heads and an executive from Denver Health. Either your venue or business is requiring proof of vaccination, or you choose to be a place where only masks are required. To apply for a mask exemption, businesses would have to submit plans to their local health departments explaining how they would verify that at least 95% of people in their buildings at any time were vaccinated. They also could opt for more limited exemptions, say that only vaccinated people may attend an intense exercise class so they can go without masks. The mask mandates in Denver, Adams, and Arapahoe counties apply to people 2 and older, while Jefferson County starts at age 3. The counties differ slightly in their plans for removing the mandates, though all said the decision ultimately will depend on hospital capacity. Denver's new mask order will remain in place until at least January 2nd. Rob Wittenstein, CEO of Denver Health, appealed to the public to follow the mask order and take other precautions to ease the building pressure on healthcare workers. About 95% of the hospital's intensive care and general beds are full, she said. We need your help, she said. We are at a point of breaking. As of Tuesday afternoon, 1,576 people were hospitalized in Colorado with confirmed COVID-19 statewide. While there are some positive signs that new cases may be starting to decrease, hospitals remain under strain with only 557 general beds and 71 intensive care beds available. Most of the metro health departments, other than the Douglas County's new Board of Health, had sent a letter to Governor Jared Polis asking for a statewide mask mandate. Douglas County left its local public health agency, the Tri-County Health Department, to avoid requiring masks in schools, though it ultimately allowed Douglas County School District to set its own mandate after a lawsuit. Boulder, Pitkin, and Larimer counties already had mask mandates in place. Broomfield officials opted against a wider mask mandate like the other metro counties, instead ordering that masks only be required for people entering government facilities like libraries or recreation centers. People who are fully vaccinated can avoid having to wear masks inside those locations by showing proof of full vaccination, Broomfield officials said. Denver had a mask requirement for about a year and lifted it mid-May when the statewide mandate ended. At the time, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had said vaccinated people no longer needed to wear masks in public, though the unvaccinated should. The upshot was that both unvaccinated and vaccinated people largely took off their masks. Dawn Comstock, executive director of Jefferson County Public Health, said that in the absence of statewide measures, counties have to work together to slow COVID-19's spread. County borders don't contain this virus, she said. Polis defers to counties. At a separate news conference Tuesday, Polis said the state's role is to increase hospital capacity to encourage booster shots and to make it easier for high-risk people who have COVID-19 to get monoclonal antibodies, which reduce the risk they'll become sick enough to be hospitalized. Several mass vaccination sites, including Ball Arena, are expanding their capacity, and the state has set a goal of helping find staff to open 500 hospital and step-down beds by mid-December, he said. Each county has to make decisions based on local conditions and what the public will tolerate, which can vary widely, given that some people would say, let them die of the unvaccinated, and others want to do everything possible to protect them, Polis said. He asked people not to denigrate local officials who may favor more or fewer restrictions than they would prefer. We're proud of all the steps the local health departments are taking that are consistent with their values, Polis said. The local orders exempt people who are actively eating or drinking at restaurants, who have medical conditions that prevent them from wearing masks, who rely on lip reading for communications, who are performing in a show or leaders of a religious service, if they're 12 feet from others, or who are participating in individual sports like gymnastics, if they're 25 feet from others. Bob McDonald, executive director of the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, said Monday during a presentation to the JEFCO Board of Health and the city that the city had decided to mandate vaccines for its employees in hopes that it would be a more successful strategy than requiring masks or proof of vaccination in certain public places. Those measures help, but getting as many people as possible vaccinated is the key, he said. We are here today because too many people chose not to get vaccinated, even though they are eligible, he said at the joint press conference Tuesday. Lexi Nolan, deputy director of Boulder County Public Health, said Monday that mask mandates were one of the less restrictive ways to meet the goals of preventing unnecessary deaths, keeping hospitals from being overrun, and allowing life to go on as normally as possible. If most of the state does nothing now, lockdowns might be the only tool left to get the situation under control, as Europe has found, she said. When all neighboring counties have similar mask rules in place, that reduces concerns that people will simply drive a bit further to go to a gym or store that doesn't require them to mask up, Nolan said. Most of our businesses' frustrations relate to not having a level playing field with other counties, she said. Multi-pronged strategy. Comstock said Monday that the latest information from the state's modeling team showed that in roughly half the situations from the current track, the state will have more than 2,000 COVID-19 hospitalizations in the coming weeks and could run out of beds. Increasing the pace of booster doses and first shots for children lowers the odds to about 46%. Small increases in transmission control, such as increasing mask wearing, drops it to 30%, and getting monoclonal antibody treatment to half of eligible people lowers it further to 25%. If we put all these together, we have the best opportunity to avoid overwhelming our hospitals, she said. Vaccinations offer the highest level of protection but don't work overnight. The Johnson & Johnson shot provides its highest level of protection after 2 weeks, but most people have opted for the two-shot sequences, which are somewhat more effective. Depending on which of the two-shot vaccines a person chooses, it takes 5 or 6 weeks to reach full protection. While monoclonal antibodies are likely more effective than masks at preventing hospitalizations, the state can't scale them up fast enough to stop hospitals from being overrun, said Dr. John Douglas, executive director of the Tri-County Health Department. Boosters also will help, but don't stop the transmission immediately, he said. That's not going to be enough, it appears, to stave off the crisis, he said. Gas prices. U.S. will release oil from reserve, by Josh Boak and Colleen Long, the Associated Press. Washington. President Joe Biden on Tuesday ordered a record 50 million barrels of oil released from America's strategic reserve, aiming to bring down gasoline and other costs in coordination with other major energy-consuming nations, including India, the United Kingdom, and China. The U.S. action is focusing on helping Americans coping with higher fuel and other prices ahead of Thanksgiving and the winter holiday travel. Gasoline prices are at about $3.40 a gallon, more than 50% higher than a year ago, according to the American Automobile Association. While our combined actions will not solve the problems of higher gas prices overnight, it will make a difference, Biden promised in remarks at the White House. It will take time, but before long, you will see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank. The government will begin to move barrels into the market mid to late December. Gasoline usually responds at a lag to changes in oil prices, and administration officials suggested this is one of the several steps toward ultimately bringing down costs. Oil prices have dropped in the days ahead of the announced withdrawals, a sign that investors were anticipating the moves that could bring a combined 70 million to 80 million barrels of oil onto global markets. However, in trading after the announcement, prices shot up roughly 2% instead of falling. The market was expecting the news, and traders may have been underwhelmed when they saw the details, said Claudio Galimberti, Senior Vice President of Oil Markets at Rystad Energy. The problem is that everybody knows that this measure is temporary, Galimberti said. So once it is stopped, then if demand continues to be above supply, like it is right now, then you're back to square one. Shortly after the U.S. announcement, India said it would release 5 million barrels from its strategic reserve. The British government confirmed it will release up to 1.5 million barrels from its stockpile. Japan and South Korea are also participating, and U.S. officials said it is the biggest coordinated release from global strategic reserves. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman, Max Blain, said it was a sensible and measured step to support global markets during the pandemic recovery. Blain added that the country's companies will be authorized but not compelled to participate in the release. Despite all the optimistic statements, the actions by the U.S. and other risk countermoves by Gulf nations, especially Saudi Arabia and Russia, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries have been made clear they intend to control supply by keeping prices high for the time being. As word spread in recent days of a coming joint release from U.S. and other countries' reserves, there are warnings from OPEC interests that those countries may respond in turn, reneging on promises to increase supplies in coming months. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso was among Republicans who criticized Biden's announcements. The number three Senate Republican said the underlying issue is restrictions on domestic production by the administration. Begging OPEC and Russia to increase production and now using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve are desperate attempts to address a Biden-caused disaster, Barrasso said. They're not substitutes for American energy production. Biden has scrambled to reshape much of the economic agenda around the issue of inflation, saying that his recently passed $1 trillion infrastructure package will reduce price pressures by making it more efficient and cheaper to transport goods. Republican lawmakers have hammered the administration for inflation, hitting a 31-year high in October. The Consumer Price Index has soared 6.2% from a year ago, the biggest 12-month jump since 1990. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is an emergency stockpile to preserve access to oil in case of natural disasters, national security issues, and other events. Maintained by the Energy Department, the reserves are stored in caverns located in salt domes along the Texas and Louisiana Gulf coasts. There are roughly 605 million barrels of petroleum in the reserve. The Biden administration argues that it's the right tool to help ease the supply problem. Americans used an average of 20.7 million barrels a day during September, according to the Energy Information Administration. That means that the release equals about 2,000 days of additional supply. Right now, I will do what needs to be done to reduce the price you pay at the pump, Biden said at the White House. He said the administration also is looking into potential price gouging by gas companies, squeezing customers while making money off the lowered oil costs. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm, too, said U.S. companies are part of the problem, keeping production below pre-pandemic levels in order to increase profits. The coronavirus pandemic roiled energy markets everywhere. As it bore down, economic activity sank in April of last year, energy demand collapsed and oil futures prices turned negative. Energy traders did not want to get stuck with crude that they could not store. But as the economy recovered, production lagged and prices jumped to a 7-year high in October. U.S. production has not recovered. Energy Information Administration figures indicate that domestic production is averaging roughly 11 million barrels a day, down from 12.8 million before the pandemic. Americans are feeling the squeeze. For Matt Hebert of Agoura Hills, California, it's taking $80 to gas up his SUV. Gas prices are definitely on everyone's mind right now, he said as he filled up at a station in his suburb northwest of Los Angeles. He hoped the president's move has a good long-term effect. Cy Amber, meanwhile, was en route to Las Vegas from his California home, unhappily spending more money filling up his car. He said he didn't expect Biden's action to work and didn't agree with them. I'm not happy with our president, he said. Republicans in Congress are pointing to Biden's efforts to minimize drilling and support renewable energy as a reason for the decreased production, though there are multiple market dynamics at play as fossil fuel prices are higher around the world. Biden and administration officials insist that tapping more oil from the reserve does not conflict with his climate goals because this short-term fix meets a specific problem, while climate policies are a long-term answer over decades. They argue that the administration's push to boost renewable energy will eventually mean less dependence in the U.S. on fossil fuels. However, that's a politically convenient argument. In simple terms, higher prices reduce usage, and significantly higher gas prices could force Americans into less reliance on fossil fuels. The White House decision came after weeks of diplomatic negotiations. Biden and President Xi Jinping of China talked over steps to counter tight petroleum supplies in their virtual meeting earlier this month and discussed the importance of taking measures to address global energy supplies, according to the White House. The Department of Energy will make the oil available from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in two ways. 32 million barrels will be released in the next few months and will return to the reserve in the years ahead, the White House said. An additional 18 million barrels will be part of a sale of oil that Congress authorized. U.S.-China diplomatic horse trading. After 4 years as a pawn, Seattle man returns home. By Erica Knetz, the Associated Press. Brussels. Daniel Hsu, a U.S. citizen, fought for 4 years to escape China. The Seattle resident was barred from leaving despite having committed no crime. Then earlier this month, just 4 days before a virtual meeting between President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping, Su was told to prepare to go home. He had less than 48 hours. It was a total rush, he told the Associated Press in a telephone interview from his home in Seattle. Su knew nothing of the horse trading going on between China and the U.S. and the buildup to a 3+ hour video meeting between Biden and Xi on November 15th. Both countries appeared to be trying to dial back tensions in their fractious relationship, and Su had become a bargaining chip. He could return to Seattle, and 7 Chinese nationals who were convicted of crimes in the U.S. would be sent back to China. China's ability to make deals by effectively taking people like Su hostage has raised concerns that Beijing may feel emboldened to double down on that practice. There's no deterrent imposed on Beijing to doing it again, said Sophie Richardson, China Director of Human Rights Watch. The problem is, if you took the truly principled road, a lot of people would still be sitting in arbitrary detention in China. A U.S. official knowledgeable about the administration's talks with Beijing told the Associated Press that Su was not a deliverable for the Biden-Xi meeting, that what looked to some like a prisoner exchange was rather the product of a long and continuing efforts to get Beijing to live up to its international obligations. The official wasn't authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Su told the Associated Press he had been effectively held hostage by Chinese authorities seeking to convince his father to return to China and face justice for allegedly embezzling roughly $63,000 more than 20 years ago. Su's father said he is innocent and the target of a political vendetta. Under Chinese law, authorities have broad discretion to block Chinese citizens and foreign nationals from leaving the country. The U.S., Canada, Australia, and the U.K. have issued advisories warning people that they can be prevented from leaving China arbitrarily. Su was not the first case of hostage diplomacy involving China. Hours after Canada released Ming Wanzhou, a powerful executive at Chinese tech giant Huawei, who had faced a U.S. extradition request on charges of fraud, Beijing freed 2 Canadians detained in China on national security charges. China's foreign ministry downplayed any connection with Ming's case. The next day, 2 American siblings who, like Su, had been blocked from leaving China for years, returned to the United States. Su's luck didn't change until the weeks leading up to the November video conference. Su got a call from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing on the afternoon of November 11th. He was instructed to get to Guangzhou, a southern Chinese megacity, about 900 miles from his apartment in Shanghai, in time for a charter flight home earlier that Sunday morning. He went to see his 103-year-old grandmother. She cried when he told her he was leaving. I could tell she was wondering if she'd see me again, he said. Su never told his grandmother about his exit ban because he worried for her health. He never told her that he had been held for 6 months in solitary confinement under constant surveillance with lights that never went off, or that his wife, also innocent of any crime, had also been blocked from leaving China until last year for reasons that were never clear to them. As a consequence, their teenage daughter was effectively orphaned in Seattle for nearly 3 years. On November 14th, dawn arrived in Guangzhou with a glorious blue sky. At the airport, Su walked across the tarmac toward a waiting Gulfstream 5 jet. Su said he saw 7 people disembark, though he didn't know who they were. Only one, Zhu Guzhang, a former Chinese bank executive, was in handcuffs. China called Zhu's return a major achievement in China's global anti-corruption fight. A federal court in Las Vegas had convicted the former Bank of China manager on conspiracy charges, and he spent nearly 13 years in U.S. prison, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Two other returnees, Zhang Yujing and Liu Jing, tried to enter Mar-a-Lago in 2019. Another two, Wang Yuhao and Zhang Jilin, illegally photographed a naval air station in 2020. The final pair, Su Yang and Tang Junlong, were convicted of financial crimes, according to DHS and Justice Department records. And then it was Su's turn. He walked up 10 boarding stairs with a single suitcase and one carry-on. It was really a relief, Su said. I took a deep breath when I sat down in my chair. Thanksgiving this year promises to be a massive improvement on the holiday 4 years ago when Su said he celebrated in solitary confinement in Hefei, where he managed to convince his minders to bring him a special meal of Kentucky Fried Chicken. Su spent the 6-hour flight from Guangzhou to Guam reading Dune in Mandarin, playing video games, and chatting with a half dozen immigration and customs enforcement officials. Then there was a 3-hour layover in Guam, a 7-hour flight to Honolulu, a 24-hour layover in Hawaii, and a 5-hour flight to Phoenix. In Phoenix, he switched to a commercial flight, which was delayed by nearly 3 hours, as Biden and Xi spoke of the need to avoid conflict. Su paced the airport, exhausted and aimless. I tried to read a book or read something on my phone. I just can't, Su said. I couldn't focus on anything. I couldn't wait to see my wife. Finally, around 10 p.m., Su touched down in Seattle. A representative from the Office of Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs was waiting for him. So was his wife, Jody Chin. I just held her and gave her a hug, Su said. A very big one. Very tight. Welcome home, Chin said. Drive by at Aurora Park. 15-year-old arrested in shooting that injured six, by Kieran Nicholson, the Associated Press. Or the Denver Post, excuse me. A teenage suspect has been arrested in the midday drive-by shooting of six teenagers in a park across the street from Aurora Central High School. The shooting happened on November 15th in Nome Park, East 12th Avenue and Nome Street, police said. A 15-year-old suspect was arrested Monday night and has been charged with attempted first-degree murder. Two vehicles believed to be involved in the shooting, a Chevrolet Tahoe and a Chrysler 300, have been found and seized as part of the ongoing investigation. Police described the incident as a drive-by shooting. The 15-year-old male was identified as the driver of the Chrysler 300, police said on Tuesday in a news release. Because of his age, his identity will not be released. Investigators have determined that at least two people in the park fired back at the suspect vehicles, the release said. Detectives are working to identify anyone who fired at the vehicles, as well as others involved. School resource officers responded first to the Nome Park scene and used tourniquets on at least two of the victims, potentially saving their lives, police said. Five of the teens, three boys and two girls between the ages of 14 and 17, were transported by ambulance to area hospitals. An 18-year-old drove himself to the hospital with minor injuries, police said. One victim underwent emergency surgery. Three teens were shot on Friday in the parking lot of Hinckley High School. Two of those injured teens are Hinckley students, and the third attends APS Avenues, Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson said. None of the injuries were believed to be life-threatening. Aurora Police announced late Friday that a 16-year-old boy was arrested and has been charged with attempted murder in the shooting of Hinckley. On Monday, police announced that two more teens, both 16-year-old boys, were also arrested in connection to the case. Police did not release the names of the suspects because they are juveniles. The two shootings of Aurora High School students within the same week have city leaders, community activists, and residents pleading for an end to violence. On Monday, council members in Aurora and Denver announced a joint gun buyback program for 2022 that would convert firearms into garden tools and jewelry. The program announced by the Denver council member Amanda Sawyer and Aurora counterpart Curtis Gardner comes in the wake of the separate shootings that left nine teens injured. Anyone with information on the shootings is asked to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Francis Dixon, November 16, 1934, and November 15, 2021. Francis came to Colorado from Missouri and married Ed Dixon soon after meeting him in Denver in 1954. Together, they established a family of four children and a real estate brokerage and were active in Rotary for 40 years. Survivors include her children, Mark, Paul, Rebecca, and Rachel, numerous beloved grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. Memorial service Sunday, November 28th, 12:30 p.m. at the new church in Boulder Valley in Lafayette. George William Fisher, 98, passed away November 21st, 2021 in Lakewood. For a full obituary, visit monarchsociety.com. Peggy Monroe, February 11, 1922 to November 17, 2021. Devoted wife, mother, and grandmother, Peggy passed away peacefully from natural causes at 99. She left a beautiful life full of volunteerism, love of family, and a big heart. Born Margaret Geraldine Scott to parents Jack Scott and Annis Caroline Wacott, siblings Lillian, Jack, Joan, and Jerry, she married Pat Henry Monroe, August 1941. Children include Vicki, Scott, Rod Monroe, and five grandchildren. She is survived by daughter Vicki, daughter-in-law Donna, and granddaughters Amy, Amanda, and Laylee. Loyal Day Reinert, Mike Sr., age 78, husband of Loma Marie Reinert of Littleton, Colorado. Celebration of Life, The Vehicle Vault, 18301 East Lincoln Meadows Parkway, Parker, 80134, Tuesday, November 30th at 10:30 a.m. Safety protocols requested. Full obituary at www.ellisfamilyservices.com. Charles Andrew Graham, Andy, February 16, 1940 to November 9th, 2021. Andy Graham transitioned from this life on November 9th after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease. Born in Kansas City, Andy grew up in Lawrence, Kansas. He attended the University of Kansas on a football scholarship. While at KU, he received a BS in business from and a JD from the law school. Andy met his wife, Connie, while they were students at KU, and they were married shortly before their graduation in 1966. Andy served as captain in the United States Marine Corps and taught military law in the Naval Justice School in Newport, Rhode Island. In 1970, Andy and Connie went home to Colorado when he accepted a position as an in-house counsel to Petro Lewis. Years later, Andy founded Energy Methods Corporation, served as its chairman and CEO, and took the company public. After leaving the oil and gas industry, Andy established First Financial Advisors, which provided financial services to individuals with a focus on estate planning. Andy retired in 2021. Andy served on the boards of Raymond James, Boy Scouts, Craig Hospital, and Save Our Youth. He was a member of the Cherry Hills Country Club, Colorado Arlberg Club, Leadership Denver, GIRO, the Colorado Bar Association, and the Colorado Estate Planning Council. Enjoying Colorado, Andy golfed, skied, hiked Colorado 14ers, rode the Rockies, and walked miles and miles on the Highline Canal preparing for the 2013 New York Marathon. Survivors include Connie, Andy's wife of 55 years, their sons Matthew Graham and Michael, wife Sarah Graham, and granddaughters Emma Graham and Nicole Graham. Memorial contributions may be made to Andy's name to the Downing House, 3680 South Downing Street, Englewood, 80113. A celebration of Andy's life will be in May. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Thanksgiving, where those in need can find free meals in Colorado, by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. Organizations from the Salvation Army to local restaurants are stepping to help Coloradans in need with free meals this Thanksgiving. If you know of a place where people can access Thanksgiving resources that should be added to the online version of this list, please email ehernandez@denverpost.com. The Salvation Army of Aurora. The Salvation Army of Aurora, located at the Aurora Warehouse at 11701 East 33rd Avenue, will serve Thanksgiving meals to residents at the outdoor shelter located on site from 1:15 to 2:30 p.m. Thursday. Miss Betty's Harvest Madsgiving. Denver chef Taha Kajahi Cook is partnering with the Salvation Army to deliver 10,000 meals across the Denver, Aurora, Grand County, Eagle County, and Poudre Canyon. Call 855-768-7977 to see if Miss Betty's Harvest Madsgiving can give you a Thanksgiving meal. The Righteous Project. From 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Wednesday, The Righteous Project, a nonprofit youth-oriented organization, plans to give away 100 free turkeys and free breakfast, free Thanksgiving meals at 11601 East Montview Boulevard in Aurora. The organization is partnering with the Plates by the Pound BBQ restaurant. Boulder Shelter for the Homeless. The shelter located at 4869 North Broadway in Boulder will provide a special breakfast and dinner for the 140 people who access the shelter's services on Thanksgiving Day. Feet Forward Boulder and Second Baptist Church, Boulder. On Thanksgiving Day, hot meals will be served from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Glen Huntington Band Shell in Boulder Central Park, located at 1212 Canyon Boulevard. The Salvation Army of Greeley. The Salvation Army of Greeley, located at 1119 6th Street, will provide hot Thanksgiving meals from noon to 1:30 p.m. Wednesday. Participants can either take the meal to go in a container supplied by the organization or sit down to enjoy their meal with others. Loveland's Betta Gumbo and City Point Church, Northern Colorado. The Southern food restaurant Betta Gumbo and a Northern Colorado church have partnered to provide meals this Thanksgiving. If you're in need, text THANKS to 970-474-5019 to get free meals for you or someone you know who's in need. The family-style meals will consist of turkey, gravy, cornbread dressing, mashed potatoes, and sweet potato casserole, buttered corn, green bean casserole, and pumpkin pie. Meal pickup is from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wednesday. Mines near Nederland alleged to have discharged heavy metals into water supply, by Deborah Swearingen, Daily Camera. The Cross and Caribou mines outside of Nederland are facing potential hefty fines if the pollution that's been alleged in the state water quality violation notice is not mitigated. The notice of violation and cease and desist order alleges the Boulder County mining operation violated the Colorado Water Quality Control Act and a discharge permit by releasing heavy metals such as lead, cadmium, and zinc into the watershed at levels that exceed what's permitted by law. For example, samples provided in June indicate there were 12 micrograms of lead per liter of water, well exceeding the 30-day average limit of 5.4 micrograms per liter. The reported violations occurred in various periods between December 2020 and August 2021. The violation notice was issued November 5th by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's Water Quality Control Division. Grand Island Resources, LLC, the company that recently took over the mines after the death of longtime owner Tom Hendricks in 2020, was 30 calendar days to respond to the notice and its allegations. A penalty of up to $54,833 per day per violation may be imposed, the violation notice states. Those fees are not definite, but could be imposed after at least 270 days if corrective action hasn't been taken. The operation discharges treated wastewater associated with the mines, which have produced gold, silver, copper, zinc, and lead, and are currently being revitalized by Grand Island Resources. According to the notice of violation, that wastewater is directed to a series of lined ponds. The water from both mines combines in the second pond and is discharged via pipeline to Coon Track Creek, which feeds into Barker Reservoir and Boulder Creek. The order requires that the mining operation work with a person or company experienced in metal mining, wastewater treatment, and management to evaluate the facility and recommend improvements. This evaluation shall consider all contributing pollutant sources and polluted concentrations from all possible wastewater sources, the order states. In addition, the evaluation shall evaluate the Cross Mine and Caribou Mine independently and address historic, current, and planned operations of both mines. According to a statement from Grand Island Resources, this work is already underway. The company is in process of installing modern, proven water treatment infrastructure to replace the last 50 years of antiquated and obsolete water purification methods and treatments with state-of-the-art systems, according to the statement. GIR regrets that the treatment system could not be installed and placed in operation sooner to prevent violations during our evaluation and revitalization of the Caribou and Cross Mines, the statement reads. However, we weren't looking for a short-term fix. The operation must create a final report demonstrating short and long-term actions it can take to reduce the impact outlined in the violation. Beginning in the new year, the order requires the mines to provide quarterly progress reports for the state. Although the mining operation located at 4415 Caribou Road is outside of Netherlands town limits, officials there are concerned about the pollution's impact on the water supply, particularly for those downstream in Boulder and in unincorporated Boulder County, where many drink from an artesian spring that could be impacted by the pollution, according to Netherland Mayor Chris Larson. They're not in Netherland, but they're my neighbors, he said. Grand Island Resources said it will continue to make investments to demonstrate that the historic mines can be operated in a manner that is environmentally responsible and economically resilient. Larson acknowledged that officials with the Cross and Caribou mines have said their goal is to do environmentally friendly mining. Netherland trustee Alan Apt noted the town recently signed a Rights of Nature resolution recognizes the inherent legal rights of Boulder Creek and the Boulder Creek watershed and giving the town a moral imperative to speak up on behalf of the ecosystem it relies on for water. It's not an ordinance, however, so the town will still need to work with the state and county on regulations and enforcement. Hello Fresh in Aurora. Workers Say No in Union Vote by Judah Kohler of the Denver Post. Workers at the HelloFresh factory in Aurora voted 166-91 against forming a union to represent the employees who put together home-delivered meal kits. The National Labor Relations Board counted the votes Monday. Mail-in voting by the roughly 350 eligible employees began October 28th. About 900 employees at HelloFresh workplace in Richmond, California, started voting November 18th on whether to form a union. The employees who organized the Aurora vote said they wanted to form a union to seek better pay and working conditions at HelloFresh, the country's largest provider of home-delivered meal kits. An accident in June that occurred when a pallet with bins fell from a high rack on four employees, seriously injuring one, further galvanized the union backers. The employees and organizers with Unite Here, a union that represents workers in the food service and other industries, had hoped to capitalize on the momentum of strikes and wage gains by people who have kept going to work every day during the pandemic. Janitors at Denver International Airport, who are members of the Service Employees International Union Local 105, won a $4 hourly raise after walking off the job Saturday, just as Thanksgiving holiday travel was getting underway. HelloFresh workers in Aurora fell short in their vote to join Unite Here Local 23 after a long anti-union campaign. Our hearts go out to the workers who organized the union because they wanted to change the disrespect, dangerous working conditions, and pay in their workplace, Kevin Abels, president of the local union, said in a statement. Throughout the process, HelloFresh has respected each employee's right to decide for themselves if they want to be represented by a union or not, company spokesman Robin Schweitzer said in a statement. We are committed to fostering open and direct dialogue with our employees and continuously look for ways to keep improving, Schweitzer said. Employees who helped organize the election criticized HelloFresh for hiring consultants to speak during mandatory meetings about unions leading up to the vote. The company said the sessions were informational. Apple sues Israeli spyware maker seeking to block its access to iPhones by Nicole Pereroth, the New York Times company. San Francisco. Apple sued the NSO Group, the Israeli surveillance company, in federal court Tuesday, another setback for the beleaguered firm and unregulated spyware industry. The lawsuit is the second of its kind. Facebook sued the NSO Group in 2019 for targeting its WhatsApp users and represents another consequential move by a private company to curb invasive spyware by governments and in companies that provide their spy tools. Apple, for the first time, seeks to hold NSO accountable for what it says was the surveillance and targeting of Apple users. Apple also wants to permanently prevent NSO from using any Apple software, services, or devices, a move that could render the company's Pegasus spyware product worthless, given that its core business is to give NSO's government clients full access to a target's iPhone or Android smartphone. Apple is also asking for unspecified damages for the time and cost to deal with what the company argues is NSO's abuse of its products. Apple said it would donate the proceeds from those damages to organizations that expose spyware. Since NSO's founding in 2010, its executives have said they sell spyware to governments only for lawful interception, but a series of revelations by journalists and private researchers have shown the extent to which governments have deployed NSO's Pegasus spyware against journalists, activists, and dissidents. Apple executives described the lawsuit as a warning shot to NSO and other spyware makers. This is Apple saying, if you do this, if you weaponize our software against innocent users, researchers, dissidents, activists, or journalists, Apple will give you no quarter, Ivan Kristic, head of Apple Security, Engineering, and Architecture, said Monday. The NSO group has dealt with a series of critical setbacks. Earlier this month, the Biden administration, in a notable breach with Israel, blacklisted NSO and Kandiru, another Israeli surveillance company, saying they supplied spyware to foreign governments that used it to target the phones of journalists, dissidents, human rights activists, and others. The ban, which means that no American organization can work with NSO, is the strongest step any U.S. administration has taken to bring the global marketplace for spyware to heel. The Israeli government, which approves any sale of NSO software to foreign governments and considers the software a critical foreign policy tool, is lobbying the U.S. to remove the ban on NSO's behalf. NSO has said it would fight the ban, but the executive set to take over NSO Group quit after the business was blacklisted, the company said. One week after the federal ban, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals rejected NSO Group's motion to dismiss Facebook's lawsuit. The Israeli firm had argued that it could claim foreign sovereign immunity. A 3-0 decision by the court rejected NSO's argument and allowed Facebook's lawsuit to proceed. Those developments helped pave the way for Apple's lawsuit against NSO on Tuesday. Apple first found itself in NSO's crosshairs in 2016 when researchers at Citizen Lab, a research institute of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, and Lookout, the San Francisco mobile security company now owned by BlackBerry, discovered that NSO's Pegasus spyware was taking advantage of three security vulnerabilities in Apple products to spy on dissidents, activists, and journalists. NSO's spyware gave its government clients access to full contents of a target's phone, allowing agents to read targets' text messages and emails, record phone calls, capture sounds and footages off their cameras, and trace their whereabouts. Internal NSO documents, leaked to the New York Times in 2016, showed that the company charged government agencies $650,000 to spy on 10 iPhone users, along with a $500,000 setup fee. Government agencies in the United Arab Emirates and Mexico were among NSO's early customers, the documents showed. Those revelations led to the discovery of NSO spyware on the phones of human rights activists in the UAE and journalists, activists, and human rights lawyers in Mexico, even their teenage children living in the United States. NSO said it would investigate any accusations of abuse, and further revelations show that it did not stop those governments from continuing to misuse NSO spyware. An opening for Apple's lawsuit emerged in March after NSO's Pegasus software was discovered on the iPhone of a Saudi activist. Citizen Lab discovered that NSO's Pegasus spyware had infected the iPhone without so much as a click. The spyware could invisibly infect iPhones, Mac computers, and Apple watches, then siphon their data back to government servers without the target knowing about it. Citizen Lab called the zero-click infectious scheme forced entry and passed a sample of it to Apple in September. The discovery compelled Apple to issue emergency software updates for its iPhones, iPads, Apple Watches, and Mac computers. The sample of the Pegasus gave Apple a forensic understanding of how Pegasus worked. The company found that NSO engineers had created more than 100 fake Apple IDs to carry out their attacks. In the process of creating those accounts, NSO's engineers would have had to agree with Apple's iCloud terms and conditions, which expressly require that iCloud users' engagement with Apple be governed by the laws of the state of California. The clause helped Apple bring its lawsuit against NSO in the Northern District of California. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County won some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado. Bringing print to life, to life, to life.
Somebody once told me the world is gonna roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed. She was looking kind of dumb with her finger and her thumb in the shape of an L on her forehead. Well, the years start coming and they don't stop coming. Fed to the rules and I hit the ground running. Didn't make sense not to live for fun. Your brain gets smart but your head gets dumb. So much to do, so much to see. So what's wrong with taking the back streets? You'll never know if you don't go. You'll never shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
And all that glitters is gold.
Only shooting stars break the mold. It's a cool place, and they say it gets colder. You're bundled up now, wait till you get older. But the media men beg to differ. Judging by the hole in the satellite picture, the ice we skate is getting pretty thin. The water's getting warm, so you might as well swim. My world's on fire, how about yours? That's the way I like it, and I'll never get bored. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
Look at all the cars. Lots of colored cars. Ah, there's a blue one. Isn't it pretty? Ooh, look how fast that red one's going. It's red like that stop sign. Like my jacket.
This is a 38-year-old man.
My jacket's not a car, is it? Is my jacket a car? My jacket is red, but it doesn't go fast.
He may sound a little strange to you and me.
Vroom. Vroom, vroom.
But to his 2-year-old son, who's interested in cars and colors, he makes perfect sense.
That's the sound cars make.
When you talk with your child, you build vocabulary, and learning starts long before school does. So follow their lead. Take simple everyday moments, like eating dinner or just watching cars go by, and turn them into learning moments.
Ooh, look, red car.
Yes, it's moving awfully fast.
Blue car.
Yes, the man in the red car is about to meet the man in the blue car. Get himself a pretty pink ticket.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.